Supervisors, please take your seats. All right, I will call the meeting to order and ask if you are here to check in on the computer. Okay, we have a quorum that takes care of roll call. Let's continue with the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
What's that? No, I assume she's going to be here. All right, under Chair's report, just a couple things. First of all, on parliamentary procedure and open meetings law, Bill and I are going to be sharing that one. With regard to parliamentary procedure, you remember at our last meeting, Brad Conkle made this motion to what he referred to as exhaust the speaker list, which is something I'd never heard of. After the meeting, he and I talked a little bit, and he explained that at UWL and their student senate, they use that, which essentially is if the person makes a motion like that, then everybody who's listed presently on the list to speak can talk, but when we're done with that, the last person who's already on that list, then debate is closed. I asked Bill to research that a little bit, and Bill says that that's pretty much the same as a motion to limit debate. And so what you would say simply is, you know, I move to limit debate to people who are already on the list or something along those lines, or I move to limit debate to 1 minute per person or for the next 5 minutes or that type of thing. And so if people are interested in that kind of thing, as you know, if you make a motion too early to close debate, I rule that out of order since we were looking for people to have a chance to speak for the first time. If you want to try that as an alternative, any of those scenarios that I just mentioned, that certainly fine. That would be within the rules of parliamentary procedure. So Brad's not here tonight, but I wanted to thank him for kind of opening our eyes on a different approach that we can take. Any questions on that at all? Oh, that, by the way, is a simple majority, right, Bill?
I'm sorry, I might have misadvised you earlier.
Oh, it is two-thirds? Okay, so it is, that does require a two-thirds vote. Not debatable, I don't think. Not debatable. Yeah, we're not going to debate whether we can debate. So, Vicky's here. Any other questions on that? Okay, I wanted Bill to give us a couple things on open meetings law, and so I'll turn this over to him. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. One more thing. Another comment that I heard from people after the last meeting was that folks tend occasionally to drift a little bit away from the topic, and people have asked me to crack down on that a little bit more, and so I've said yes, I will do that. But that's a two-way street. If other board members hear somebody that's getting off the topic, point of order would be appropriate, and you know, so it shouldn't always be the chair. Because I get a little reluctant because I don't want people to think I'm picking on them, that I'm always doing it with a particular person. Other than if it's Ray Ebert, I wouldn't feel bad at all. But he's in my class, by the way. He's my star student. But what I'm asking is that if you think that people are getting off the topic, raise your hand, point of order, and we'll deal with that. You know, if we can, I think our meetings generally flow pretty well. That last one, there wasn't a full moon, so I have no explanation of what it was. Might have been hungry before lunch or whatever, but most of the time we have pretty good meetings, and I want to kind of keep it going that way. But, you know, if things do start to drift, then don't be shy in that regard. So those were the 2 points I wanted to make. Sorry, Bill.
I believe that you wanted me to comment on the walking quorum issue.
Yeah, that's an issue that I think we're well advised to hear every once in a while because that can easily trap people, and we've heard those horror stories around the state of people that had inadvertently crossed the line and get in trouble. And so I just wanted Bill to kind of, and I'll probably have him do this every year or so, just to remind people that that is something to think about. So go ahead, Bill.
Yeah. I guess this has been a subject of many of the Attorney General's meetings or seminars on open meetings, and that is to advise public bodies that you can violate the law through what is called a walking quorum, which is a series of meetings of less than a quorum of a governmental body, but with the intent to either tacit or expressly to reach a quorum in a certain action. Certainly one of the ways that you can do this is, you know, face-to-face meetings. That would be something that would be common, I think, in the past. Telephone could result in this, but certainly with this new age of electronic transmission through emails or texting or, I guess, even the social networking kinds of things, you can achieve the same result, which would be a violation. In other words, if you send an email out to all of the board about a particular issue that's going to come up before them, and members start to reply back and forth and have this debate and discussion over email or whatever other electronic means that you have at your disposal. So be very careful about that. You certainly can talk to members outside of this body, but be aware of not trying to form a quorum through an understanding with them until you get to the meeting that's properly noticed.
A couple points I would make in that regard. One is that the simple fact of a quorum of a committee or the full county board does not necessarily constitute a violation of the law. We could have a party at some downtown restaurant, for example, and have everybody there, and that's not a violation unless you start talking about issues before the board. If we talk about the Packers or the Brewers or, you know, whatever the case may be, that's not a problem. It's when you start talking about issues before the board that then you do get into a problem. So keep that in mind. Second thing to keep in mind is this concept of what's called a negative quorum. And that issue came up the other day when we had that vote on the, where it was not a budgeted item with regard to the referendum for transportation. And because it was not budgeted, it takes a two-thirds vote of the full board to pass that, meaning one-third of the board could stop that. So if you have one-third of the board talking about how we're going to stop that, you have a violation unless that takes place within the auspices of our meeting. And so keep in mind, if you're getting together to talk about an issue or you're making phone calls or sending emails or whatever the case may be, a little light should go off in your head saying, do we have too many people involved in this, and are we talking about an issue before the county board? Because if either of those things is the case, you really need to think long and hard before you do that type of thing. And as always, anytime you have a question on any of those things, call Bill. He knows the answers, or he'll get the answers to you. So before you screw up, ask Bill the question. Yeah, John.
Yeah, I'm kind of familiar with this, and I know that people in the local government have gotten burned on this, but we kind of watch federal government or the state government, which is partisan, and a lot of times they don't go to the floor until they know they have the votes. So they've counted their votes in advance. Because otherwise, why go to the floor and lose if you're the majority party? So for state and federal partisan offices, the law is different than it is for nonpartisan local offices, correct?
They've exempted themselves.
Okay, so what they do on that level doesn't apply to us at this level, correct?
That's correct. They, you know, the open meetings law requires local governments to be open. I guess it doesn't require the state to be open themselves.
Right, and I think I just wanted to clarify in my own mind because I thought that was the answer.
Sure.
But also in this body, in counties, for example, where you don't have an executive, Steve Doyle is our chairperson. He's a member of this body. He's a member of this legislative body. For example, in a city where you have an executive mayor who calls members of the city council, for example, and lines up, you know, can I count on your support? And you get to 9 or 10. Is that illegal then? Is the executive branch separate than the legislative branch under this walking quorum thing?
My opinion on that, tell me if you disagree, Bill, is that the mayor wouldn't be looked at as any different than, let's say there was an issue, talked to Audrey recently about ambulance. Let's say that somebody from Tri-State called every city council member to line up their vote. I don't think that's illegal at all. That's lobbying, and I think that the mayor, because he's not a member of that body, can lobby. And
but the mayor is a member of the body.
Is he a voting member?
He only he votes to break the tie.
Break ties.
So is he? Or
well,
is
there's
he
a question for the Attorney General's office. Then
yeah.
I don't know. Do you have? What do you think, Bill?
I guess I've never considered that with regard to the mayor. Certainly with regard to the county board chair, I agree with Mr. Menninger that yeah. you are a voting member of this body and could end up violating by doing that very thing. But I guess the mayor is a little bit different. And
I'm not talking about any skeletons in any closets for
yeah.
for purposes of anybody here. I didn't know in my own mind.
Well, I think the analogy at the county, because we don't want to have you ruled out of order for getting beyond what we're talking about, would be the county administrator. If Steve O'Malley called people on an issue, he's not a voting member of this body, so I think he could do that. Mm-hmm. But it would certainly be inappropriate for me or a voting member of this
yeah.
body.
Usually, I know I've seen this decision from the Attorney General's in various contexts, and oftentimes it's regarding sending out information by email. You know, staff is often asked to do that, and it could be on an ordinance, it could be on a resolution. And as long as we don't invite a reply back, you know, it's okay. We can send you information about a certain topic. That is not a violation.
Jim Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to clarify, I mean, this doesn't prevent correspondence between members unless its intent is to somehow
form a quorum to decide a particular issue. Because again, you know, if you're forming a quorum, you know, to pass or defeat a certain action of the body, and this is done outside of the open meeting, it would be a violation.
But Bill, what if Jim sent a letter to every county board member saying, I'd like you to vote this way on a particular zoning
yeah.
issue? Would that be a violation?
No, because you know, there's no agreement. I mean, you're not asking for a reply back.
I see. In that. So if I were to pull all the members and say, what do you think about this issue? That's okay. If I were to say, I would like you, I really appreciate
well,
your
polling
support.
Is a problem. I think
yeah.
polling is what we're talking about.
Okay, so if I call a member and say, like, I'd really appreciate your support on this issue, that's okay.
As long as it's a one-way communication that you're not trying to, trying to achieve a quorum, I think you can give them information. You know, I think that this has merit, should pass, provide information. But it's when you try to create that agreement, you know, outside of the open meeting, I think you've got a problem.
Okay, so just asking them how they feel on an issue, that's okay.
Well, I think you're getting close to the edge when you ask them how they feel.
If it constitutes a quorum.
Quorum.
Or something, if you
I
call
mean you,
three or four county board members who aren't on a particular committee voting on it, not a problem on that.
Okay.
You're okay. I mean, this is not intended to prohibit people from discussing things. That's a good thing. It's just if you try to line up the votes, whether it's at the committee level or at the full board member level, you have to keep that in mind. I see Jill.
What if someone was, say, running for second vice chair, and they would call members of the board and ask, say, I hope you'll consider voting for me?
She would probably go to jail for that.
Oh, okay.
I actually asked Bill that question a few years ago, running for chair myself, and I don't know if I got a clear answer, but I think that would not likely be prosecuted.
Well, that's traditionally been done on our board. Letters have
right.
been sent, or
yeah.
not asking how are you going to vote, but giving information that I'm running, and I would.
I think that the polling is the problem. You know, where you're trying to get agreement. If you're just saying, you know, I want to run for this position. I think I'm qualified. Would you know, please support me? I don't think that's a problem. It's when you try to have this discussion with them. You know, if you vote for me, I'll put you on a committee or something like that.
I can't do that.
that's kind of going across the line.
Never crossed my mind. Actually, I never made that. I don't think anybody here could say that I ever did.
Steve,
and if you
if
would
I could
say
just,
that, I would kick you off the committee.
If I could just make...
Go ahead, Bill.
One other thing that I just want you to be aware of that you may kind of walk into innocently, generally, and that's where multiple members of a committee or the board attend a meeting of some other body. And you need to make us aware of that. If you know that there's going to be a quorum of your committee, or in some cases a quorum of the board. We try to then include on the agenda that the committee that is coming to that meeting may be present, but not for the purpose of taking a vote or taking any action, but for information. But you still, if there's going to be a quorum of your committee at another meeting to get information, it really needs to be noticed. So make us aware if that's going to happen. If one, and frequently I see one or two of you or three of you on various committees attend the executive committee, and that, as long as it's not a quorum of the committee that you're on, it's not a problem. It's when you reach that quorum, you need to make note of that and let us include it on the agenda.
Tara?
What if that happens accidentally? Or you arrive and you discover that there is a quorum of one of the committees?
Somebody needs to leave.
Just leave, okay.
Well. Now, if
sit at different tables,
let's say it's
or something.
Executive committee, and there is an issue. Let's say Health and Human Services has an issue before executive committee, and it turns out that a majority of Health and Human Service board members show up at executive committee. It is already noticed that we're going to be discussing that issue, so I'm assuming that's okay then, right?
Discussing the issue, but if the Health and Human Services board shows up, we need to include on them that they may be present.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So are you saying for any meeting, Bill, or just our meetings? I mean,
we've done
outside public events, you know, those kinds of things.
We're not talking about chance social gatherings.
All right.
You know, if you all end up at the, you know, the county fair or something, or
breakfast,
you know,
or something.
If it's a social gathering, that's not a problem.
Okay.
It's you know, and I think on occasion, not too long ago, we invited the city to come over for a meeting. I forget what that issue was about, but I believe on our agenda we'd indicated that the members of the council may come. So again, it's kind of one of those odd things that you can walk into accidentally, and we really need to notice it. If there is that issue on Health and Human Services at executive that a quorum is going to attend, we need to make sure that we note that.
Okay. Ralph?
Well, why don't you just notice it on every time we have a meeting? If we don't have a quorum, so what? Just notice that we will have. May have.
Well, I think that would be contrary to the spirit of the law. I mean, we've had that discussion. Well, you could say on your agenda, we may talk about any issue that we've ever brought up before in the past, and you've got it covered, but I think that would clearly be contrary to the spirit of the law to bring up something that wasn't specifically listed. So to, on every agenda, say that we may have a quorum of any other committee, I would not feel comfortable that that is in compliance with the law.
Who determines who leaves, and under what authority do you have? If
I would say
the worst case scenario, if nobody wanted to leave, you'd have to adjourn the meeting.
I would say it's the same rule as with a restraining order. If somebody's there first, the second one leaves. That's how I would say. Last one who shows up leaves. I mean, that's the only fair thing that I could say. Don, you have your hand up, or had your hand up?
Yes, I did. It was a follow-up with what Bill was talking about, and you just were talking about. If the health department were in the human services meeting and listened to a proposal, they don't get a vote that night. They might be biased in regards to whatever issue they're talking about, and that, so they don't actually get a vote when human services vote something up or down. But
we're talking about government. We're talking about elected officials, Don. We're not talking about staff.
I would agree with you, but they could all be county board members. And that doesn't mean that, well, the issue you talk about in whatever department may or may not come before the county board as a vote, because there's a lot of issues that are finalized in committee now and doesn't come back to the county board. So I think there's any number of other things you got to consider when you have, like myself, going to some of these meetings, and you know, we may not get a vote at the county board level on whatever issue it is.
It doesn't matter, Don. It's not whether you get a vote. It's whether a sufficient number of the secondary committee that would constitute a quorum shows up at the noticed meeting.
But that, how does that conflict, because you may not be in agreement with the other committee
doesn't
members.
It doesn't matter
and
if you're in
agreement.
It's that. Sheer presence. It's just because you're there to gather information. You know, I'm just trying to tell you what the law is. You can argue whether it's a good law or bad law, but that's the law.
So if we all went to a town board meeting talking about new zoning rules, that would be illegal for us to be there? I disagree
with
that.
No, it's not illegal for you to be there. It's illegal for you to discuss things there. If you happen to be sitting there and not saying anything and just listening to what the town board is saying, that's not a problem because you're not trying to influence the outcome.
Okay, but if
you all chirp in,
okay, but
then
if
you
I'm
start
the only one,
problem.
It's okay then.
Absolutely, if it's just one that, because then you're not a quorum of
it's
something.
It's a fine line.
The whole reason I asked Bill to talk about this is that I don't think there's a single person in this room that would ever do this intentionally. But as Bill said, local governments have fallen into it accidentally, and the consequence is pretty serious if you get nailed for that type of thing. So the whole point of tonight's discussion here is just be sensitive on that issue. Think every time you're in a meeting where there's other people, look around, see who's there, and ask yourself if there could be a problem. That's all we're trying to say tonight. Any other questions anybody has? Steve?
I was also going to make the comment that if you or your committee wants to have a joint meeting, we can do that. If we anticipate an agenda item, I know when we meet with the chairs of the committees to try to put the agendas together, if there's some item that's going to bring in another committee or something that's that critical, we can post it that way. I would venture to say if we did have that situation, we don't have to exclude somebody. We can just table that item until we can get an agenda for a joint meeting. So, it's not a matter of excluding anybody. It's protecting you against prosecution for violation of the law. We can easily put together joint meetings and protect you so that it's properly noticed.
Okay. Let's move on to the next item, which is supervisor conference reports. Anybody have any? Mr. Mina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I made this pitch before. We have a statewide RC&D conference coming to La Crosse September 23rd and 24th, which is Thursday and Friday. Thursday is kind of a workshop or a regular meeting plus tours. The Friday conference would be the better one. It would be, we're talking about biomass, river fall migration, conservation and energy, woody biomass, perennial growth, basically alternative fuels. And we'll have people from all over the state there. And this was up on the bulletin board. I will put it back on the bulletin board, so if you could make it for one day. The fee isn't that great. The total registration is $95 for the full three-day event, but we will break it down to whatever you're there for.
Okay, thanks, Don. Anybody else have any? Sharon Hampson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I recently went to a LADCO meeting, and we got a plaque. And this is the Triangle of Achievement Award, and it has to do with Mississippi Valley Health Services. So they were recognizing the collaboration of La Crosse County and a consortium of 12 other counties and the Wisconsin State Legislature, because we had some of our local legislators working in Madison to get this done. So it's for cooperation, leadership, and commitment. And there you are. We're exemplary.
All right. Congratulations to all of us, I guess. Anybody else? Bev Mock.
I attended the August 26th Wisconsin Economic Development Summit, and it's the second of three. The next one will be October 5th in Milwaukee. We were given a document called the Outline for the Wisconsin Prosperity Strategy, and the input from this summit here in La Crosse will be added to the next draft, and then after the October meeting, they'll come out with a final draft. I attended a couple of workshops, the education discussion and the local government services discussion. the education one I'm interested in because that's what is my field, and also the fact that we need well-educated people in Wisconsin to be better prepared for good jobs and help with economic development. CESA is looking at a new vision for public education, and some of the ideas that were expressed at this particular discussion group were that besides a new vision, we need quality of education as a whole, and it needs to be improved a lot more. There should be improvement in connection between school districts. There should be consolidation of services and a better use of technology. And at college and technical schools, they're discussing how it needs to be easier to transfer credits than it is now. There's really a movement to do that, but it's still kind of complicated, and we need to get it less difficult to do. We need to have tuition that's income sensitive. Tuition is going up because of the problems with funding, but we need to discover what the incomes are of some of these students and perhaps assist them a little better. We need to do a better job of attracting talent to the field of education, and we need to look at statutory changes as far as education is concerned. Also, there were many other ideas. At the local government services discussion, I discovered that a lot of things that were being suggested or talked about are things we're already doing in this area, but it was fun to hear about it. We should have the state take a hard look at how services are being provided, looking at state standards, regulatory standards, and statutes. We have to have revenue enhancements somehow, and sales taxes being looked at. And maybe the rationale could be that we're directly assisting the education UW system, or maybe public safety would be some ways to rationalize some of our increases in state taxes. Another person said we need more cooperation between intergovernmental units, better alignment between local and state government. Urban areas need to work together. Someone talked about mediation and arbitration needs to be reformed, open the door for innovation. Although I feel that in our case, again, we seem to be doing pretty well with that and working with the unions. We need a partnership between local government and schools, another thing that we're attempting to do in this area. We need to think about aligning our funding cycle with the state and schools. And we've already talked about that here, too. We sure wish it would happen. It was stated that towns are not against regional service collaboration, but they are opposed to the idea of consolidation of government. Many of them are. We need to examine the property tax exemptions that we have, and we need to do the same for sales tax and broaden it according to one person's feelings. We need to encourage consolidation of service, and the incentive might be to penalize a community if it doesn't consolidate. Those are only a few of the ideas that were thrown out, but I thought it was a worthwhile day for me to sit in, and there are 11 points in this statement, and these two areas that I went to were just part of the points of that strategy for the future.
Okay, thank you, Bev. Maureen Friedland, did I see your hand up? Anybody else? Okay. One last thing before we go on to the administrator's report. On your desk, you have the invitation to the UW Extension open house. That would be this Thursday. I'd certainly encourage people, if you have a chance between 3:30 and 6:30, to stop by there and find out what they do. So, again, that's this Thursday. All right, Steve.
Great. And one last item, I'll mention it again Thursday night. Friday, after our county board meeting, there will be an open house at the Solid Waste Department where they'll be giving tours and those types of things, as well as presenting the summary of the solid waste assessment. Again, that study that was jointly done with the City of La Crosse and City of Onalaska does not have any recommendations, but it identifies a range of options for our two major cities and the community, really, to consider in how we handle solid waste collection. So that'll be interesting if you have a chance to make that. That's Friday. I'll mention it again Thursday night at our regular meeting. Proclamation, September 2010, Libraries and UW Extension Month. Whereas educational programs for agricultural professionals, businesses, communities, families, and youth are brought to the residents of La Crosse County, and whereas educational and library programs identify and respond to specific community needs for education, research, and knowledge to improve the quality of life in local communities, to strengthen families, to increase the competitiveness of businesses in agriculture, and to develop leadership skills for managing resources and planning for the future. And whereas libraries provide recreational and educational resources in the pursuit of lifelong learning, and whereas UW Extension programming combines faculty, campus-based specialists, and staff expertise in the areas of agricultural horticulture, community natural resources and economic development, family living, education, and 4-H and youth development, and whereas UW Extension faculty and staff and area library staff are committed to educating the residents of La Crosse County in order to promote lifelong learning and provide a more knowledgeable and informed community. Now, therefore, be it resolved, the La Crosse County Board does hereby proclaim the month of September as La Crosse County Libraries and UW Extension Month and urges all residents to join in recognizing the valuable contribution of persons dedicated to educating the residents of La Crosse County.
Moved by Arlene Benrood, seconded by Tara Johnson. Discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried unanimously. Hopefully people brought their budget book. If you didn't get it out of your locker, go grab one now. Steve's going to be talking about the budget.
And one of the pieces is obviously there won't be any quiz on it tonight because you just got it, but there are some inserts that obviously do some summarizing of some of the key issues you may have anticipated or we've anticipated that you would like to walk through. In addition to that, as always, I have a PowerPoint presentation. So, wow, how unusual. So, Gary, if you could help me pass this out to board members. I think the front desk have this, and I'm going to go through basically a summary, and then we'll come back to the actual handouts just to be able to touch on some of this. And what I'm hoping this does is gives you a broad overview of the entire document. And, of course, you've got all the detail line items, and we'll go back through our usual committee process and board review process. So anytime you've got something in particular that you don't think I've highlighted that you want to discuss at future agendas, please make sure to do that. Obviously, when we go through the budget, you'll be able to do that with any line item or those types of things. But if you've got a particular issue that we haven't prepared adequately for you as far as bringing you information to debate, make sure you identify that. Some of that is already in here in anticipation of that as well. And I'll go through the PowerPoint, but I believe you have a question there.
Well, I want to make one pitch again, and that is, if you have suggestions for cost savings or budget efficiencies or whatever, let staff know. If you wait until the budget deliberation in November and you make some motion that comes out of nowhere and the staff hasn't had a chance to research what the implications on that would be, you're going to have a hard time convincing board members to support it. If you talk to staff ahead of time and say, you know, there's a particular area I think maybe we could cut here, whether they agree with you or not is irrelevant. What they can do, though, is to figure out, okay, here's the line items that we would need to deal with. You know, here could be the other considerations and so forth. And they'll have that discussion with you. But if you wait until November, you know, until the budget meeting, they won't have the ability to do that, and that's going to make it probably next to impossible for you to be successful.
And let me follow up on that. It's not so much that if you want to cut a particular line item that we need to know every thought in your minds of making that motion. But quite often, many of these line items are connected to other things. They will be connected to revenue streams. If it's just a line item, oh, I don't know, Supervisor Ebert may bring up, oh, that stadium contribution again. I don't need to know that. I just predicted it, and it will probably happen. So I am a seer into the future. That one's probably not as big an issue, but we've had issues where a supervisor proposed to make a major change in fund balance allocation, $1 million shift. On the day of the board budget adoption is not the time to start debating that. If you've got a major issue or you're unclear of the relationship between an expenditure item and a revenue item, we will help explain that to you. You have every right to make any change with a majority vote in this budget, but just let us help you if you've got something. Again, if it's a small item or a singular item that we've already seen happen before, that's not a big deal. But it can end up relating to many other things. And cutting gross spending, for example, may not save any levy and may be, you know, it may be counterproductive, and we can help you identify that if you work with us, either myself or Gary, of course.
And by the way, Steve has asked county employees for suggestions on cost efficiencies throughout the county and got 7 to 8 pages worth of suggestions. And we also have asked county board members, and we have how many so far? Zero.
So far.
But we know they're coming, right? We know they're coming. Tara.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure that staff follows up with supervisors who are not here tonight. My recollection is that last year we had a little bit of a drag in the process because there were several people who missed this meeting and then were asking questions at the next stage of the process that had been answered at this meeting. I know it's their responsibility to get the information and hopefully read through it and possibly even sit down with staff. But if you could be proactive in at least mailing the PowerPoint mm-hmm. or sending an email reminding them that we went through it tonight so we perhaps avoid a repeat of that from last year, I would appreciate it for one.
Well, and even people who are here tonight, if you want to sit down with staff, if you have questions, they work for us. So don't hesitate. Don't be shy about it. They're more than happy to sit down with you and go line by line if you want to the whole thing.
And I know we keep picking on Supervisor Ebert, but he's come in with lists of things that he wants to talk about. We've spent that time, and I'll do that with each and every supervisor if that's useful. So if you've got things you want us to follow up on. The other possibility, just to follow up, should we post a presentation at 5 o'clock prior to Thursday's meeting and make it available in case board members that weren't able to be here? I'm willing to do that if... and it would also be an opportunity for people if between now and Thursday you have questions that come up. We don't have any other committee meetings. I'm here, obviously, so maybe we'll do an amendment to the agenda, just posting that item as a... and if it's only 2-3 of us, that's fine, too, but does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, so everybody's invited to that. It's not mandatory. Your usual meeting will start at its usual time at 6, but we can make that available as well. Any other questions? Okay. Each of these presentations I've done, especially recently, I've tried to bring you additional comparative data that's coming out, and I wanted to keep bringing that information to you. As you know, we spent quite a bit of time. Really sets the context. We did a whole detail before in July and June, giving you a lot more of the substantive data. If we... and most of this presentation will not be on the substantive data from comparative. Mary Powell over there, if you could switch that next slide. Mary Powell, by the way, if you don't know, if you haven't been on the board a long time, is really our key to putting together this entire budget document. She deserves a lot of recognition and support. She works with, on behalf of the finance department, with all of our departments, and each of the individual finance staff work directly with major departments in helping them put this together. But Mary is the key in putting the documentation together and analyzing the effect on our community and budget. I really want to thank Mary, and probably will do that more than once during this process. Gary does a good job, too, but Mary's really the... as I've said before, we've done a lot of presentation to show you that based on everything and all the analysis we've been able to do using Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance data and comparing with other counties, we have among the lowest property taxes for the county portion of property taxes in the state. We continue to be the fifth lowest per capita in the state. In addition to that, we are the lowest among our comparable counties, and I believe when you account for some of the changes not budgeted in Eau Claire, I believe we even rival them as well as one of the lowest among comparable counties. Boy, this isn't going to work today, is it? Whoops. Okay. The next several slides, and they're in front of you, and I just want to quickly go through them. If you subscribe to or receive the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance information, you can get their individual data on the actual website. But what I've summarized in these next five is our ranking compared to counties of similar size, as well as the per capita. This is the latest comparable information that's there, as well as I'll do one slide that was from the May issue on debt, because I think that's important that you understand comparability as well as you know, some of the conscious decision making. The statewide average for operating capital and for 2008 operating and capital budget, La Crosse County's ranking is 68th out of 72 counties. For the total, the average is 890, and we're down in the. I can't read without my glasses. Sorry about that. I used to be able to read when I first got here. Oh, I can see. $681. This is from the latest information, which updates the 2005 information that I provided with provided you before. The statewide average for general government, again, is 115. We are 63rd in that, rising only to second out of our comparable counties. General government would be county clerk, admin, finance, general government. I don't have. I have their data. I don't have the detail on how they broke all this down. I'm going to do that more on one slide that I'm going to get to give you a little bit more information. Public safety, and I believe that's all jail and law enforcement. We actually rise to the middle of the pack of comparable counties, 43rd out of all statewide. Remember, all of these next slides are included in the total 890 per capita spending. So while we overall try to spend less, have a lower total level of expenditures, it's clear that we're right in the ballpark on what communities are spending per capita, counties are spending per capita on public safety. We're within $1 of the statewide average. Supervisor Sobranek has a question.
You mentioned the jails. Are any of these other figures from any of these counties include what they're doing with jails?
This would be the operating expenses. This would not be debt. I'll talk about debt in the last slide. So this would not include debt service. The next one is highway and transportation, and I don't know if this is a good thing or a bad thing. We tend to rank pretty low, 65th out of 72 counties in our spending per capita for highway and transportation. Again, I'm not sure that that's a positive, considering some of the unmet needs that we have, but the data is what WTA has put together.
Ralph? Microphone.
On that previous slide, was justice sanctions in human services costs, or are they in jail costs?
I don't know that for sure. I think it'll probably be in the human services slide. It would not easily be picked up by WTA. If they were just getting budget documents, they wouldn't know that justice sanctions was in the health and human services, so I would expect that would be different. But I can work on verifying that.
Jim Burns, did I see your hand up?
Yes.
Okay. Dan Bina?
Whoops.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, about 4 years ago, we got a survey from all the counties in the state in relation to the public safety and jails and whatever. And at that point in time, maybe it was at a statewide meeting, there were 52 counties building additions or renovating the jails, so that is a kind of a flexible number depending on whether that county got into it or is still hoping to get into expansion of the jail or renovation of them. But just about every county is doing it in the state now.
Okay, and again, most of that would relate to a debt decision or a debt servicing decision as opposed to operating costs. Unless you had a major increase in staffing. This is just operating and capital expenses apart from debt. The last slide will deal with that, and I'll talk about that to some extent. The next one that WTA has done is the statewide average for health and human services per capita. Again, we're not the lowest. We're certainly not the highest. We're ranking about 60th. Now, whether or not in a community does have some challenges with people in poverty and those types of things, whether that's something to be proud of, I do know that a part of our control of health and human services per capita, and one of the reasons our levy has been quite a bit less, is our innovation, particularly long-term care in care management organization. Most of these other counties had not gone through that and taken that off of the levy. They were still levying directly for care management services to long-term care clients, people on waiting lists and those types of things. So this is a clear demonstration of one of the reasons I believe we're lower in per capita levy for health and human services is strictly because we've been able to take that off of our levy. And the support from people like Dean Rupert and Jerry Huber and board members that actually led the charge on that. And I showed a slide one time which showed where exactly that ended up helping us control tax levy costs a number of years ago. So that's a big impact on that. And once everybody is in family care and it's no longer on the property tax levy in these other counties, it'll be interesting to see how much that impacts the rest of them. Again, it's still being paid for by taxpayer dollars through the state government, but it's no longer on the property tax.
Chair Johnson. See a hand there?
I would guess, but maybe Dean could help, that among our comparables, for sure Fond du Lac and Eau Claire have managed care or have family care districts.
But not Marathon. In 2008. Not in 2008.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, Fond du Lac did back in 2008 because they were
true.
Pilot.
That's
but they're
true.
Probably the
You're
only
right.
one
were,
of our comparables.
They were one of the five, yeah.
Dean, were they the only one of our comparables then?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Just Fond du Lac. Okay, thank you.
Okay. So again, this is additional data representing independent analysis and doing comparisons and showing the ranking, which continues to verify what the overall data is showing, that our spending per capita is among the lowest in the state. The last item is a little bit more complicated, and I think it's very important to recognize and to scrutinize our use of debt. This comes out of the Wisconsin Taxpayers May issue, which talked about the use of public sector debt. And the first item that you're going to recognize is we are ranked pretty high in our use of debt. And I want to talk about what that means and why. The statewide average out of 72 counties is about $25 million total, or $319 per capita across county as of 2008 now. Because again, this doesn't include the 2009 debt issue, is at $48.5 million, about $430 per capita. That would rank us 19th. Now, that's included in your entire levy, remember. This is not in addition to your total levy. We're fifth lowest, including debt, including operating. So what does all that mean? The fact is that we are the highest among our comparable counties, but we do a number of things that other counties don't do. Specifically, I went through, and I'm going to do some additional follow-up, but I believe only Marathon County out of all of those counties has a landfill. None of the other counties has a waste-to-energy plant. Now, this is kind of a history lesson for some board members. So if you exclude $25.94 million, all of that debt is not serviced by property taxes. That $25.9 is serviced by landfill fees. One of the largest portions of that is, at the time of 2008, about $9 million left of remaining principal on the waste-to-energy changes in the smokestack. All the scrubbers and the environmental things that we agreed as a community to invest in, we issued over $10 million worth of bonds for that. Again, we're the only county in the state that has waste-to-energy, but again, that's not subject to property taxes to make that debt service payment. Obviously, you call it general obligation debt because if landfill fees were not sufficient, right, who has to pay for it? Property taxpayers. That's why you want to be very careful about issuing debt. You want to have the backing of a sound business plan at the landfill before you issue that debt. But if you exclude that 25.9, which is all solid waste debt, this is in the detail of your comprehensive annual financial report, by the way, and the $1.12 million of business park, which is paid for, again, not by property tax levy, but by TIF and grants and other revenues, it will leave us with $21.386 million, or about $190 per capita of debt serviced by general obligation or property taxes. So we'd be about 48th. Now, I'm not going to kid you. We still use debt significantly, and that's why I've been very cautious, because this is through 2008. What did we do in 2009? We issued the rest of the debt for the law enforcement center. So if you add that $19.5 million, we'll get back up to about 31st. So again, that's why I'm very cautious when we talk about issuing of debt. You should scrutinize those decisions. They're not easy. But we should always come back to that still, in comparison to most other counties, we're doing more with our debt authority than most other counties, but we're not using property taxes to service that debt. And we've made a decision as this community in particular to operate a comprehensive waste-to-energy and solid waste system that will provide for our needs for 30, 40 years into the future. But we're using our debt authority and the borrowing ability of low interest rates to be able to make that happen. That's why our number tends to be quite a bit higher. And when 2009 comes out, I'll redo this analysis and see what that does. But it's important that we scrutinize our use of debt. Again, this combines the information from WTA and the information that you have in your comprehensive annual financial report.
Steve, would Hillview-Lakeview debt be included in this?
At this point, neither one of them has any debts. So
I mean, if we're going to do this bonding for the Hillview project?
I believe that would be reported as general obligation debt, right?
Okay. All right. Any other questions?
Okay. Again, I hope that's helpful. If you are interested in going to the WTA website, all of that individual data is there. Or if you want the background data, I can obviously provide that for you.
And so, I would mention to the board, next month at this meeting, our policy planning meeting, we have Todd Berry from the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance who will be here to address us.
And I'll be forwarding all of these presentations that I've done to him, so if he has any comments or corrections or, you meant this, but here's what I would have said. So, again, I'm using independent data, and we'll have him have a chance also to react to any of the information I've put together.
Ralph.
Is there a way we can contact him or something? Specific questions, you know, that he may have, so he has time to.
He and Steve are going to be talking ahead of time. So if you have anything that you want, Steve know, and he will pass that on him.
Okay. This PowerPoint, like La Crosse's position 68. Well, 5 years ago, maybe we're 68. 10 years ago, we're 68. 20 years ago, we're 68. Maybe we're average. I mean, the one that's number 10 20 years ago, are they still number 10 or do they go to 5 or 20? You know, their comparables, are we all in the same position and we've all just maintained it?
Actually, a lot of the movement has changed, especially Mary, for example. She and I, we're tracking the ones that are closest to us each year, especially the first thing that we do is we look at what's happening after we adopt a budget, what happened to the other counties that are close to us. A lot of that shifting has happened. It hasn't been drastic shifts, yes, it does change a little bit.
Well, you know, my point is, with binding arbitration and all these different laws the state has put under us, whatever your position is, what's Bob Taunt doing? He's calling up 20 comparable counties. What are you guys settling for? Oh, we're all at 2-1, or we're at 3, or we're at 1, and the unions and everybody else doing the same thing. So if they're getting the same increases, everybody's position doesn't take major movements one way or the other. If somebody goes from 30 to 50 over a period of 10 years or 50 to 30, I'd say that was a significant move. But we're here all the time.
Yeah, and it takes
a lot. I mean, the only move we could make is probably in the wrong direction.
It takes a lot to maintain that because I know when I was in Mariner County, we dropped from 20th to 24th. I actually tracked this when I was in Mariner County of the 3 years I was there of how we actually reduced that by what we were able to do with levy. It takes a lot of work to maintain at some of the lowest when we have the same mandates as every other county. But I know I'll never convince you, Ralph, because you have that same argument every time.
So. Well, yeah. That's why I want Todd Berry, maybe somebody a little more independent, forward-thinking or something.
Sure. That's fine.
What our comparable counties have done, not them all, just our comparables, what have they done in the last 20 years? Where were they 20 years ago, and where are they now? Are they all better, worse, or the same? You know.
Yeah, and I showed you the last 5 years, for example, with all the same counties. So, again, we've maintained our position, and it gets tougher every year. So.
Bill Feehan.
I thank the chair. Say, Mr. O'Malley, I subscribe to the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, and my recollection was that we had the highest tax per capita of any county in the state. And I notice here on this slide that you separate out the debt for the landfill and the business park, and then you mentioned that this slide only goes through 2008 and does not reflect debt service for the new law enforcement center. So I understand that the $26 million roughly in service for the landfill and energy projects and all that is somewhat different, but isn't it true that when you add all this together, we do have the highest debt per capita? Am I mistaken about that?
Yes, you are mistaken. We're 19th, and I've actually got the actual data from this. We do not have the highest debt per capita. We are 19th at $48.5 million. That's what I'm reflecting there.
But this is through 2008, right?
Right. But once you add the $19.5 million, we had already sold part of the debt by this point. The $19.5 would probably move us to 7th if nobody else changes anything else about their debt. So if we're going to update this to 2009, we should know what everybody else has done as well. Okay. So I quoted the best data I have available, and then show you as of 2008 the amount of debt that is for solid waste in 2008, right, and the amount for Business Park. But we were not number one. We were 19th, and that data is right here. I can give you a copy of that. That's on
in
the
2008.
In 2008.
But this does not reflect the 2009.
No, no one has done a comparison for 2009 yet. I just, by adding the $19.5 million, that would move us to actually between 8th and 9th.
Okay.
But that assumes no one else has sold any other debt, or that we haven't paid other debt off, which is part of it. So, again, I can't do that without knowing all 72 counties' balance sheets. So I'm just giving you the best data I have and the best information I have, most up to date. But, no, we are not number one in that case.
Okay. Thank you.
Anybody else? Questions or comments? Okay. Keep going, Steve.
Okay. Again, this is some of these slides are very similar to what the executive committee received, but I've added some additional information, as you've seen from the comparison, as well as of some of the updates and corrections as we finalize things right up to about 5:30 this afternoon. So, again, we continue to have many of the same challenges and the cost drivers and difficulties in being able to identify new revenue sources for 2011. And obviously the next state budget is going to put us in a position that we can't make our challenges more difficult. But with the structural deficit that they have and the reliance on stimulus, we must expect that they will end up impacting us in the 2011-2012 budget. Also, previously I was quoting out of our 2010 budget book an estimate of what our scheduled LEC debt payment would go up. The amortization schedule had indicated 815. Once it was actually finalized, it was actually closer to 873 for next year. So that will increase our total levy by 2.9%. Now, I'm still working on some additional options and ideas for you, but that's actually what's before you in the document for you to consider to start out with as the county administrator's budget. Now, the maximum operating levy under the 3% levy limit that the governor passed in the last budget, along with our unused levy authority, $2.2 million of unused levy authority, because we haven't always levied to the max, would mean that under the governor's budget and the 3% levy limit, we could increase, if you were willing to vote for it, our total levy by $2.9 million. That would be a 10% levy increase. However, everybody remembers my discussion about the rate limit, right? That's just under the levy percentage freeze, the 3%. Because we've had unused levy authority and the $740,000, which is 3% of your 2010 levy, your operating levy, we could go up by that much. However, the 1992 rate limit imposes a lower limit on us because of our low tax rate and because of the drop in equalized value. As I predicted, it didn't go down as bad as I thought it might, but it impacts our choices. So let's talk about that as we go into these next two slides. This is one of the reasons that I've brought you a budget that's this tight and this strict. Gross expenditures, and if you want to follow along with any of these, they are in the yellow page that's actually the first page in here that summarizes all of this, and it's actually on the back of this comparison. Some people's eyes might glaze over when you look at this, but it's in your budget book, and then it summarizes the entire document in these next couple of points. Gross expenditures are up 0.25% to $133.758 million. The place you can see that is in this portion of the box down below, so you can actually trace back each one of these percentages that I'm going to talk about. So the entire gross expenditures are virtually flat from 2010 to 2008. Your total operating expenditures actually decline by about 0.42%, and that's in this line item where you see total operating expenditures, 128.2 million to 127.7. It actually declines slightly. Your tax levy rises by 2.99%, all directly related to the LEC payment, not to operating expenses. Your operating levy is held at zero. You can again trace that directly back and see the operating levy line of $23.856 million in 2010 is exactly the same for 2011. People following that? Your library declines by 0.44%. The rate is unchanged at 22 cents. Oh, I skipped over the operating rate. Even with a 0% increase, right, we're not increasing the operating levy at all, your mill rate for operating went from 308 to 311. Everybody remembers why? Equalized value dropped. If spending stays the same, equalized value drops, your rate goes up. Okay? And it gets more complicated than that. When you increase spending and equalized value goes up, your taxes go up, your tax rate goes up faster. And I'm going to explain that again in a second. Because when you get to the debt levy, we've added in that $870,000 payment, means that your debt levy went up by 25%. It went from 3.4 million to 4.3 million a year, right? Okay? So that's an increase of 872,000. You see that where it says total debt? You follow that along there? Okay, and then you'll also see the percentage where it's summarized again in the gray box, 25.46. So it raises your debt rate from 0.44 to 0.56. For many years, we were able to maintain under the 0.52. Some of you remember in the previous years where we've debated that. Again, that's partly because of the increase in debt payment, right? But it's also partly because of the decline in equalized value. So the total mill rate goes from 3.74 up to 3.88, which is a percentage, coincidentally, of 3.74%. It has nothing to do with the 3.74 mill rate. What it means is you're only increasing spending by roughly 3% to make that debt payment that we plan to do, but the impact on the rate is actually slightly higher because equalized value drops. Does that make sense? When equalized value drops, spending stays the same, it raises the rate. So what would that mean overall, and why are we bringing in such a tight budget when you're in a position that you actually have levy authority you could use even within that rate limit? The fact is that the budget is under the 2011 3% operating levy. Forget the unused levy authority. You could raise your tax levy by $740,000 and do good things within the community. If you did that, that would get very close to the operating rate limit that I've talked about. So let me just use a couple of examples. There's so many different ways you could look at this. But the first example is a levy increase of just over $1 million would bring the operating mill rate this year for 2011 to 324, and then you'd be frozen. That'd be it. You'd have no other room to work. You'd have no other place to go. And if equalized value drops, you'd have to cut levy then to actually make up the difference. Look at it another way. If we raise the operating levy by the 3% increase that many counties will be doing this year of $740,000, which again is less money for us because our levy is already lower than others, and equalized value next year drop by 2%, you'd already have to start the new year 2012 decreasing levy by $175,000 just to keep at the 324 rate limit. 2012, yes. So if we increase this year, this calendar year that you're about to debate, by $740,000, you're already close to a problem right away. And then next year, if we don't get any change in the rate limit and equalized value drops, you'd have to cut levy then just to be able to stay within the rate limit regardless of any new costs or any budget cuts or any new demands. By the way, that's not academic. The average decrease in equalized value for the eight counties closest to us in size this year was 2.7%. Ours was how much? 0.89. We actually are doing a little bit better. Now, I can't predict that long term, how long we will continue to be in a better position from a market-based standpoint, but that's why I've been so strict on what I'm bringing you. I believe we do best to not make our challenges more difficult into the future by doing everything we can to hold the line. We've still got to make the debt obligation that we committed to when we built the law enforcement center, but then we need to be in a position to have the maximum flexibility when we see what the state and federal government does in the next budget cycle. I see at least one hand.
Ray Ebert.
Yes, sir. Okay, so the eight other counties that went up the 2.7%, are they not limited by that 3.2% or 3.2 rate?
Well, let me just correct. Maybe I misspoke. Okay. The 2.7 is the average drop in equalized value that they saw. And my example there is I was predicting if we drop by 2% next year, which is certainly easy, it could happen because other counties drop by 2.7%.
Okay, my apologies. I thought that was a percent of the rate. And that might have been because they didn't have the 3.2.
No.
My apologies, sir.
And,
thank you.
And the other thing that you'll find, especially for those of you that are going to WCA, most of them last year weren't real concerned about the rate limit. There are a couple of us that are concerned about it. I'm talking to more and more counties that are getting closer and closer to that. Rock County, for example, was quite a ways away. They saw an equalized value decline of, I think, about 4.5%. They're getting there. They'll be there within a year or two. Most counties, even those that have a much higher rate than us and those that are close to us, are catching up to this rate limit because no one was expecting equalized value to drop at the level that it is. So, again, you're going to find more and more counties that are interested in at least helping to deal with some of this.
Don Bina.
I guess we haven't gotten very far into the budget, and you're just going through the preliminary numbers, but there's a mandatory 10% cutback in departments on the state level that they're trying to work with at the state level. Nobody knows what's going to happen when the new politicians get their new jobs and get back to Madison. There may be a 10 to 15 to 20% cut in some departments at the state level, which flows back into us, and we will get cut accordingly. How much flexibility have you got here? And it looks like you do have a fair amount of flexibility by holding it to $740,000. So there's still, we have some flexibility yet, but we're going to run out of that flexibility if the aids either from feds or the state start drying up on us.
Well, hold on that thought, if you could, Don, because
okay.
When I get to the one-year strategy, I'll talk about some of that flexibility and some of the issues that I've
okay.
tried to account for.
All
okay.
Right.
If you hold on that, that's a good thought. Okay, so that gives you an overall view, and those of you that have worked with me long enough know that that is the lowest operating change that we've had. This is the tightest budget we've been able to bring you in. I believe this is the eighth year that I've done a budget for La Crosse County, my 26th year of doing budgets for local governments. And so what I'm trying to do is put us in the best position we can to react nimbly and flexibly when we see what happens with the state budget. We always do the pie charts to try to give you an idea of where your total expenditures are, because remember, we have a $133 million budget, and the majority of that budget is not from property tax levy. So if those other revenue sources are fixed or changes, it puts more pressure on what? The property tax levy, right? So you see where we spend most of our money. Again, I've already saved by not printing these in color, so I apologize that you're trying to look at black and white, but they don't give me a color printer. They're afraid that I might make too many color copies. So actually, I won't get a color printer. But the next one, and this is really where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. This is where we struggle to be able to control the impact on property taxpayers. This is a summary of our 2011 tax levy, $29.8 million. There hasn't been a lot of shift, except that the biggest increase in that, of course, is our debt service. It's representing a larger and larger percentage of our entire pie, but you still see that well over half of our budget is devoted to human services, courts, and public safety. Very difficult areas to cut, very difficult areas to decrease in levels of service. You can't have a shift of jailers without having an adequate number of jailers posted in that position. You can't not do child abuse investigation when it's reported. You can't not provide service to the mentally ill when they're in need of it. this makes it very, very difficult to be able to deal with items, which, again, is why the one-year strategy deals with some of that. Let's also just review quickly the equalized value. I've done 30-year graphs to show you this, but you'll notice that we've been very, very stable, but you see that slight decrease in that last year is what's impacting this. One would expect that over the next couple of years, we're not going to resume that level of rise that we've seen within our lifetimes. So over time, it's actually, if you adopt the budget or somewhere close to what I've brought you, it doesn't look like the property tax rate, the mill rate, is going up all that much over a 25-year history. You actually see that we're lower than we were back in the early part of that graph 21, 22 years ago. However, graphs can be misleading, right? So let's go to the next one, which shows you more specifically the most recent period of time, which is 2000 through now. Last year, when we had an equalized value increase of 2%, and we held the line on our budget so that we were at 2.6% was the total. It was almost identical to the rise in equalized value. That's why the rate was flat. Guess what's happening this year? You're seeing quite a spike up from the 374 to 388. The difficult part is going to be while we're asking for difficult bargaining times with our employees, we're looking at everything we can to control taxes. If the equalized value continues to decline, you're going to see that rate go up. And Mary, if you could back up. At some point, if that trend happens, we will rival the tax rate that we had back in the early part of this slide. Now, again, it doesn't make it any easier, but that's what I'm trying to anticipate and trying to help us control longer term and help us monitor that. That's why we've done so much analysis for the last 31 years, trying to see what other recessions have done to us. And in addition to that, I think I've mentioned in this forum before that there are national analysis and studies that are saying if local governments and state governments balance their budgets by major impacts on layoffs of positions and employees, it will doom the ability of the economy to come back out just by that number of jobs. There are predictions of well over 500,000 positions of layoffs being predicted across the nation because every state and local government is in a similar position except, I think, two states. So there's a balancing act that we have to have in controlling property taxes, controlling expenses, but also controlling and preserving services and positions because we can end up impacting the local and nationwide economy as governments as well, while also not meeting the needs of our communities that demand services in difficult times. So this becomes, there aren't a lot of easy answers. I've said that several times, but that's an example.
John Manninger.
Just on that equalized value, it's less than 1% for the county of La Crosse. Do you have that broken down by municipality or, you know, because my sense is that perhaps the downtown equalized valuation is going up because of logistics health, but maybe Onalaska is going up, but Southside's going down. Or how do you have that broken down?
You're right, but remember just right away, downtown doesn't impact this because it's in a TIF. So the growth of value within in that benefits that area and will help pay off. I mean, the more building you have, it'll pay off the bonds earlier for the city of La Crosse, but it won't benefit us until that TIF closes.
But it's counted for purposes of equalized valuation, though, right?
Right, but that's taken out of this number because we don't get to tax that and actually receive that revenue. And I'm not disrespecting TIF. It's positive. It's a great thing for downtown and the other TIFs. All I'm saying is it doesn't generate us new tax dollars for the levy today. And the development wouldn't have happened without the TIF, right? So, again, but that's not included in this number. That's why if you go to the gross number on the Department of Revenue site, you'll see our equalized value only went down by 0.5%, not the 0.89 that's here. You have to take the TIF districts out because we don't get to tax it and actually get that money. Of course, the person in that district pays county taxes, right? But all of that is swallowed up based on that tax rate and goes into paying off that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense, but I just didn't know if you had those numbers broken down by municipality. And I understand that the TIF business and how it works, but my sense is that, and we've seen this year after year, is that the city's portion of the county's property tax levy continues, the city of La Crosse continues to decrease. and the rest of the county continues to pay.
And I would expect even in a declining economy, we're going to continue to see that. And if we get all of the data like I did last year, and I think it was November or December I brought that information to you when property tax bills went out, I hope you don't mind. We used you as the laboratory, so to speak. The board members' property tax bills. We actually showed where district by district what had actually changed there. And you're right. City of La Crosse basically saw a flat line, and most of the other properties outside City of La Crosse were the ones that actually picked up that increase. It gets complicated because of the equalized value and a number of other things. Mary and I are still struggling, along with Gary, to try to figure out a way how to give you a prediction because, again, predicting in a rising market is much easier than a declining market and rising taxes to make a levy payment for debt, right? So we're going to try to give you more information, but we just weren't able to solve that, not today.
Bill Feehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned the potential impact on our economy of cutting these government jobs, and I thought we were going to see numbers on the number of county employees at some point in this process. I'm curious, you know, how has our employment grown over the last decade between the collectively bargained and non-collectively bargained positions? You know, how much have we increased the workforce in our county government? That's something that I would like to see, because the other side of the argument that I think you make is that people in private business are laying people off, and they look at the government and they say, well, why haven't we had those people? Why aren't they experiencing the same types of job losses that we are?
Well, and I agree with you to some extent, Supervisor Feehan. This budget and the next budget will not be without pain. It will not be without impacts on positions. And I'll talk about some of the ones that we're actually doing in this budget. All I'm suggesting to you is that's not an easy answer. And it can end up impacting the rest of our community. It will also impact the rest of our economy. If you want a detailed explanation, and I can do another slide for you at the next October meeting, it's in the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report that each of you have received. Page 156 gives you the 10-year history of all employment. Actually, from 2008 to 2009, we went up slightly from, now again, this is full-time equivalent as of December 31st. We went up actually from 1118 to 1144, roughly about 26 positions. 21 of those were in nursing homes. And we actually budget based on and actually staff based on census in each one of those. But I'll do a slide on that will break all this down at our next meeting. But if you want to look at those details and ask me any questions, that's already here in the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report. Some of the other increases, by the way, are things like the ADRC expanded, where we got state revenue to serve a regional set of entities in the care management organization. So again, not local property taxes, but I can walk down and break that down for you.
I'd like to get that. I was excused from the July meeting, so I do not have that information.
Was it the August meeting? Anyway, you should get a copy of the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, and I'll make sure that the October meeting we talk more about that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Ray Ebert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your 2011 tax levy, $29.8 million, could we also get that chart thrown in with the sales tax? Because actually, by using the sales tax applying to any of these, you could actually change that pie graph substantially, correct, with the $9 million in sales tax to make things look either more or less, depending
you'd
on
have
where
to make
you plug in that money.
We apply the sales tax in the non-departmental, so we don't apply it to individual departments. So you'd have to make a value judgment of how are we using it against which department. If I understand correctly, can you go back to that pie chart on levy? To apply the it's the same thing with shared revenue. We get $4.6 million of shared revenue from the state. If the state cuts shared revenue, guess what? You're going to have to debate where's the priority of where the cuts are, because that's used across the whole organization. So I can make the same argument with shared revenue, is that any place we levy, we're using shared revenue to reduce that levy, right? Okay, if most of our levy is in human services and courts, are we going to cut jailers to be able to make up for the loss of shared revenue? That's going to be kind of hard, right? Okay, so my point is it's the same thing with sales tax. We budgeted for $9.5 million next year. I don't have all these figures memorized. That's in the non-departmental budget. we would have to make a judgment of how it actually applied against each one of these areas. Would you apply it equally against every levy area? Would you only apply it? It wouldn't reduce debt service.
Well,
or
but
would
don't
it?
You guys can? You're using actually the sales tax as a substitute for
property
general
tax
levy,
levy,
correct?
Which is the law.
So therefore, why can't we just lump them together and do this? Redo this chart. I think it would be. I would find it interesting because I think we can play some games with sales tax by putting it against certain things and not against other things. And almost the same thing we do with indirect costs is we can change program costs by not including the full cost of the program.
Recognize that what we do with sales tax is we apply it directly against the bottom line of the whole levy. The only exception to that is we use excess sales tax specifically for economic development purposes, and that removed it from direct taxation the year we did that and every year since then. So we've tried to be as transparent as we possibly can on doing that. I mean,
it wouldn't be a hard graph to do, though, would it, to add the $9.5 million in there and just redraw that graph?
But would it wouldn't actually change
the proportions. It wouldn't change any of the percentages.
So, I mean, but it wouldn't change the proportions, would it? I mean, instead of 29.8, it would be 30.
It would just be out of the $38 million or whatever.
Right. But, I mean, I think wouldn't the proportions all be the same?
Yeah.
They would be if you're equally doing it. However, if you're targeting the sales tax to certain property or things, then you can actually change the percentage.
And that's what I said,
correct?
Is we're not targeting it except for, as I just explained.
Just
for economic development. And that's been very transparent, and that's been debated each year that we've done that.
Thank you, sir.
Any other questions or comments? Okay.
Okay, let me go back to where I was at. These are all good discussion, good input. So, again, our one-year strategy, and I've talked about this before, but I've tried to summarize it in one slide, is to preserve options for 2012 because, again, we can't budget in the dark and anticipate where or how or what choices are going to be made by the legislature and what that impact's going to be. I will predict for you, and I don't think I'm out too far on a limb, they will cut what our revenue is. But we do not know where they will do it, what aids they will do it in, or what options they will give us to deal with that. Let me use for as an example. They could cut us in shared revenue and give you the Hobson's choice or the difficult choice to say you could levy it back. That would be an interesting debate, huh? You could get the choice that you possibly could, at your volition, increase a sales tax to try to make up for some of the cut. There would be other options that they might give you, or they could just say, we're cutting you and you've got to cut and that's life. Or they could cut you in basic community aids in human services and tell you that you no longer have to do X, Y, or Z. Do you think they're going to give us any mandate relief? Well, I can keep hoping. My point is that we need to consciously, slowly, and diligently watch and see where they cut, what those impacts are, and what choices are in those areas, rather than cut in anticipation of an unmet or unknown situation. But we also have to make sure that we don't make our challenge any tougher, which is why I'm bringing in the budget that I am. So what we want to do as little harm to programs and services as possible. Future cuts, I believe, should be tied to the specific programs. So if we get cut in highways, I believe that's where the cut should be. You'll have to debate that, whether you agree with it or not, but that's where I'm going to go first. If they cut us in human services aids, that's where we have to target the cut. If they cut us in shared revenue or something else that's non-categorical, then I'll present to you a list of options and choices, and you'll push back and say, what about this and what about that? But at least we'll know what the cut is rather than budgeting in the dark. And again, the good news tends to be that when the state, in the last several times that they've had major deficits and they have cut us, they've usually done it in the next two calendar years of their biennium. They usually, at least in Wisconsin, tend to cut us in the final 6 months of the year. I don't know if that's going to be the case this year. I know that the governor across the river would actually cut counties and cities in the last 2 months of their calendar year. That could happen here. I don't know, but at least I'm hoping that our new governor, whoever he is, will follow the practice that they've done in previous times and make most of the cuts, giving us enough time to actually prepare for that rather than doing it in the last couple months of our calendar year.
Audrey.
Thank you. One of the ways that they've done it in relation to the schools has been withholding payments for a month.
Right.
Our reserves would probably be sufficient, wouldn't they, to... by just depending on how long they deferred it, but at least for a month or two.
Potentially, but remember, and Chuck's reminded us many times of this, we get shared revenue in two payments, right? Mm-hmm. They've already delayed 85% of shared revenue to, I think it's November. See, and that's what the governor across the river did, was they had done the same kind of cash flow game with local governments. They had delayed the payment till I think, December, if I remember my work over there. And then to balance their budget, a big part of it was to postpone a school aid payment and to eliminate a certain amount of city and county school, what they call local government aid, in that December payment. So it's a big target.
Yeah, but at least the point I was attempting to get to is that it's important for us to retain our reserves order we can deal with that cash flow situation.
Right. It gives us more options. You're right.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay, so the second bullet point is, and basically the message that I've brought to the bargaining units and I've brought to you, is let's not make the challenge any greater. Let's hold the line on wages and benefits and all costs to the best that we can. We're not bargaining through the newspaper on this. We've shared information with them. We're still working with them, but it's one of the reasons I brought you the non-union pay resolution. First is to also ask our employees to be a part of the solution into 2011, so that we don't make our, if we can't levy for that amount and we used reserves, or we did increase the levy and got close to that rate limit and couldn't do it the next year, that would make our challenge that much more difficult. So by holding the line the best we can, and we're asking for our employees to help us do that, we then haven't made our situation more difficult. We're not making it harder the following year. Does that make sense? I hope it makes sense to the bargaining units, too. The voluntary unpaid time off, we've talked with bargaining units as well. I'm sorry.
Well, obviously it makes sense to the bargaining units. What happened at Mercury Marine? What happened today at Harley-Davidson? When they actually voted to take 20 and 30% pay cuts and knock out a couple hundred jobs on top of it. So sure. They would love to be in that situation.
Sure, Ralph, and I don't mean to make a difficult point of this, but the difference is that bargaining units in public sector have binding arbitration. It is about the cooperative relationship. It is about working together, because Mercury Marine could threaten to move the jobs elsewhere. Harley-Davidson is threatening to move the jobs elsewhere. Anybody think I can threaten to move La Crosse County's government somewhere else? It can't happen.
Work on that one.
Yeah, on that one.
My point was, they're aware of what's going on.
They are, and I don't think we should sell our employees short by any means. You know, we do not have an agreement yet. We're still working with them, but they understand the significance. Many of the employees are dealing with the people that are in difficult economic times. Our human services department, I mean, people in the court system. You know, our employees have a good working relationship with us. They're listening. They're working with us, and we need their help, and that's what we're trying to do this year. And, you know, we harm ourselves if we demonize them and make them the target. They know that we've got issues, and they're working with us on it. And I'm going to show you another slide in a moment that talks about the history of how they've worked with us historically, too. We've got a great group of employees here, and I'm going to show you that in a moment on the next slide.
Jim, did you have your hand up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve, do you have, when you finalize negotiations with each bargaining unit, do you roll those out individually, or do you roll them out like 5 or 10 at a time? How do you announce, when you report back to us?
There are resolutions that will come back to you, as always. There are 8 bargaining units, and our personnel department is in negotiations with all units.
And once it's done, then you announce all the settlements, or do you announce those settlements as they come?
I don't know what you mean by announce, but a resolution has to come back
before
here,
the board for
just
us
just like
approve.
They always have.
Okay.
Each as it's approved.
Okay. Each one.
Okay, the third bullet point is that many counties and cities in the state, as well as state government, have just imposed furloughs on employees. We've continued to do, and we'll do one more year of trying to see if we can get voluntary participation. We've created a new system of how they're able to actually bank vacation and actually spread that loss of compensation out over the entire year. You'll recall that, and if you look in the details, I'm taking an additional 5 days off without pay. That's a way of banking vacation. Management staff will continue to do that and lead the way. The union president has indicated that she did that this year. She's likely to do that again. We may get to the point where voluntary is not enough. We may at some point for 2012 have to have mandatory layoffs, much like the state and others have done. But I'm asking for a voluntary settlement on the contract. I'm asking for voluntary help on reducing that impact, because not everybody's situation is the same. You may have two clerks that work next to each other, one that's a single mom and the other one that can afford to take more time off because she has a partner that works, and that if she takes some time off, she's able to take that cut, but the other person next to her is not able to. So a voluntary system allows us to recognize that not everybody is exactly the same. Some people can afford to do more of a cut than others, and so we're trying to work with that. Again, it's not the be-all, end-all, but it is a better means, I think, of working with our employee groups.
Dan Ferries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the voluntary furloughs, do they have to come in certain blocks of days or one day a week, or could they take the week?
They actually have a couple of different options. You sign up for either unpaid time off, so tomorrow I'm going to take off to entirely, and it's going to be unpaid, and I have one less day in those 2 weeks to be paid. That's one way to do it. The other way, and what's preferable for most people, is what's called vacation buy-up. So we will have a sign-up period. Let me just use myself as an example. So I'll sign up for 5 days off. We've already budgeted that I will not receive that pay next year, so you'll see it as a negative in there. What that will do is I will take that 40 hours as a deduct spread out over 26 pay periods, and that will add to my vacation bank, but I'll pay for it in 1/26th. So it will add to my vacation. So you take 40 hours divided by 26, I think it's, what, about 1.5 hours a pay period, roughly? So that's the vacation buy-up program that we established for people. So next year, if I wasn't going to do that, I wouldn't sign up again, and I wouldn't have it, but I would have already paid for that extra vacation by having it deducted from my pay. So I can spread that loss of income out over the whole year, which tends to be easier for folks than saying, okay, next Friday I'm not going to get paid, and so I've only got 9 days paid out of the eight days in the pay period.
Okay.
Or 10 days in the pay
period.
Thank
you. My point is from a previous employer of mine, they'd have voluntary layoff, call it furlough mm-hmm. or layoff, and some people would take weeks at a time or a week at a time, which would make them eligible for unemployment. It's an encouragement for them to take more time off, especially coming into the fall with hunters and family vacations and squeezing things in. It would be one form of encouraging people to be able to take a week in a block. And then be eligible for unemployment.
Right. First of all, we don't want to incur unemployment because that just increases the other costs. The other pieces are it can't increase overtime. That's why it's at the discretion of the department head or supervisor. Many of our operations, roughly half, are 24/7 operations, both nursing homes, law enforcement, the jail. So a significant number of our employees are 24/7, so it makes it much more difficult. Okay. But when somebody can use that as an example, and within their department other people are able to cover for them, they could take that entire 1 week off, and that's happened. So again, it's up to the department head and the employees that are involved. We have areas that aren't able to take time off because their workload is just that strong. Economic support, for example, is an area that they haven't been able to take advantage of this because the demand and the caseload is just that much in a difficult economic time. You can understand that. So again, this is not the be-all, end-all. It can't solve everything, but all of these things together can help get us there. At some point, if we're not able to provide the service, we will have to discuss, probably in the 2012 budget, which services we actually have to decrease or get out of.
All right. Thank you.
Yep. Okay. Also within this budget, there will be some management positions that will be eliminated from the budget. We're going to start a process, and I've talked with the three department heads that are impacted. You will, by the end of October, actually see positions that we are changing and reducing the number of management positions within the budget. Not union positions, but management positions. In addition to that, we are going to eliminate a couple of open positions that that are not going to be in the budget, and we're going to start a systematic and formalized way of examining all vacancies that come up, as well as systematically throughout the organization, re-examining our management to employee ratio, looking at are there potential department mergers that might help resolve some of the oversight issues and save there as well. But we're going, for example, Pete Ide and Pam Sem have started to work very closely together in analyzing ways of doing oversight differently. Are there ways of saving in non-direct care staff in how we provide oversight to our employees, how we provide everything from management of work therapy, administration, management of social work, any number of things where we're looking at, and some of those will end up saving us in the 2011 budget as well. So I'll give you more details as we get closer. You can imagine that this is quite sensitive for individual people that will be impacted in their jobs in 2011, and we're working with them directly. One example is that my budget actually shows a 10% decrease in home health staffing. The caseload in use of home health is going down. We need to work with the bargaining units and with the staff that are impacted there. Again, this is not a budget without pain. This is not a budget of business as usual. And I want to make sure I emphasize that. While I still talk about the impact we can have locally, while we're meeting increased demand for services, we need to be conscious of the impact we can have on the local economy, but it's not a budget without impact to our employees and to our workload. This is a difficult budget. To get a 0% was not an easy task. I've got a few more gray hairs than I lost a little bit more on top over this time. And I was more surly, wasn't I, during most of the meetings? Yeah. But we continue to be engaged with our employees on the budget-saving ideas. Now, I'm not going to kid you. There weren't earth-shattering ideas that came out of employees and said, well, gosh, if you just did this, it would save $1 million. But they were very conscious, they were very deliberate, and there's a matrix that UW Extension helped me put together, and eventually we'll bring that back to employees. You'll end up seeing impacts on that. And a number of them are ongoing items, some of them that we're already working on, some that are brand new ideas and directions. Part of it is actually forcing us to do a lot of what we've talked about here, which is to looking more closely at management employee ratios, looking at vacant positions. So again, a lot of this bubbles up not just out of union employees, but out of management employees asking us to look at things more closely. Sustainability ideas, ways of conserving energy, ways of conserving paper, those kinds of things. So again, we're asking our employees not just for help at the bargaining table, but also tapping into their creativity to try to help us deal with the budget as well. Again, they're not instantaneous decisions. A lot of them aren't able to be implemented yet in the 2011 budget, but they're going to help us prepare that flexibility that Don talks about for additional items and changes, so you will have more to consider in 2012's budget as well. So again, that's my one-year strategy summarized in this big, thick document that you got, but that's the result of how we got to those numbers. I do want to touch on, if we can go to the next slide, but I don't think it's switching, is we, and I've emphasized this before, but we do have a very strong history of collaborative labor relations. Our employees have stepped up. When some counties were giving larger raises, our employees were willing to do the kinds of raises that you see here, a pattern of 2%, 2%, a 2-1 split, and a 2-1 split. We're at the tail end of that pattern. Somebody might say, well, why do you have a 2-1 raise in this calendar year, 2010? Don't we have a difficult budget already? Isn't the economy already hurting? Remember that this three-year pattern was set in 2007 when the economy was doing quite well. Other counties were, in cases, giving more than these raises. Our employees stepped to the forefront and cooperatively put together an agreement that actually showed that pattern. In fact, it was the highway union that set the stage at a 2% for 2008, a 2-1 split for 2009, and a 2-1 for 2010. When was that set? In fall of 2007, when the economy was doing better than it is now. So rather than trying to get a wage reopener, which is virtually impossible to do in a labor relations settlement or setting, we said, well, let's honor what we have, but that makes it more difficult for us in the future, so now we're asking for the employees to help again. I also do want to touch on that during
just
that period.
Just a second, Steve. Okay. Bill Fien has a question. Yep.
My question is, if the this pattern was sent in 2007 that we have today, what is the pattern that will be set for the next 3 years that we're starting today?
Well, the first pattern is that people aren't doing as many multiple-year settlements. The counties that are doing multiple-year settlements have a lot more taxing authority and aren't at their rate limit, and they're settling higher than we're able to, and our message is that we're not able to do that. And that why we're looking for a one-year settlement is to wait to see what happens with the rate limit, what happens with other revenue options, and what happens with the state budget. So it may be a couple years before we see a multi-year settlement. The problem is, as Bob Taunt talked about last year, or last meeting, is that if you go to arbitration, it's automatically a two-year settlement, right? So if we're not able to get an agreement and we were to go to arbitration, we would get a 2011 and 2012 settlement from an arbitrator. And I'm asking our bargaining units to work with us, preserve our options, help us and help them to preserve positions into the future, but to ask for 1 year, and let's not overreact. None of us has a perfect crystal ball. We don't know what's going to happen in the state budget. I can tell you what I think might happen, but hopefully I'm just being a pessimist today. Hopefully something great happens in the next couple of months, but so anyway, sorry, that's a long answer, but I don't see us doing a lot of multi-year settlements like we did unless the economy comes back like gangbusters.
Well, I commend you on the work that you've done on this budget that I've seen so far, and I thank you for your answer.
The last piece I wanted to touch on with this slide is obviously people talked about the Wisconsin Retirement Benefit. Historically, the total percentage that counties pay, and I didn't get this added to the slide, is still less than the percentage we used to pay, but actuarially it's going to put more and more pressure on us to make this an issue at bargaining. We'll have to see what happens over time with that, but because of the loss in the stock market, it has impacted the viability and actuarial soundness of Wisconsin Retirement. It's one of the best in the nation actuarially because it does impact existing annuitants. People receiving retirement benefits are impacted when the economy or investments don't work as well, but I actually broke that down because that is a true cost for us. The last item that I'll touch on is health insurance. In 2009, 2010, and 2011, our premiums have not been going up as much because our employees, I believe, are working with us to help to control costs. We've got a lot of wellness programming and a lot of things that employees have been working with to try to control how much they're going to the doctor, how much they're actually utilizing, and it's showing up in our experience so that your 2011 budget reflects a 0% increase in health insurance premiums. And again, so many counties aren't seeing that type of impact. So all I'm trying to do is summarize in one slide the kind of relationship we've had with our bargaining units that we expect to try to foster into the future as well.
Don Vina.
I am kind of curious. You know, the retirement is really costing us a fair amount of money because you can go back a number of years when Tommy Thompson was the governor, and they made some bad investments, and we had to put a fairly large bill to the state to make up that difference that they lost. And now we're doing it a second time. Is that 0.6% that you show for this year including
correct, but
that
you're mixing
amount
up two
that
things
we had to come up with?
Right, but you're mixing up two things. One is the prior year service, which I'll talk about in a moment. That was in 2004. That was a funding mechanism that we had to do for prior year service. Yeah. What I'm talking about is actual current employees, the percentage that's paid for the employee and employer share that in 99% of all public sector employment agreements and employees, it's paid for by the employer. It was bargained in as that. That 0.6 is part of that.
Okay, but it doesn't include both borrowing that we had to do, and it was probably about $5 million, and that is a direct cost to us that is not reflected in
right, that's not in part of the bargaining unit settlement.
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah, this is strictly the labor contracts.
Okay.
Any other questions on that? Now, I'm not proposing any of these. I'm comfortable with the budget that I've presented you. I think it puts you in the best light, but you as policymakers have to make that judgment yourself. Additional policy options, mostly that I think you will consider in 2012, but some that you may want to consider in 2011, specifically debt refinancing and, in particular, the LEC state trust fund loans. I'm going to talk about that in a moment, but we just sold those in 2008, was the $10 million total for the Law Enforcement Center state trust fund. We levied taxes to make those payments, and that's already built in there. But those rates, we're at a taxable rate. We may get better rates right now, and so we're examining what those options are. Remember, we saved. There was no issuance cost on those, so we're being very careful. We always knew that they're amortized for 20 years, but with a 10-year balloon. Everybody knows what that means, right? Is that at the end of 10 years, you've got to refinance? But it's amortized over 20 years. Well, this seems to be probably the lowest interest rates we're going to see for quite some time. So we're looking at is that while we're not making as much on our investments, should we relook at whether or not to reissue that debt? So that may be a decision we bring back to you to amend the administrator's budget. I believe in 2012 and beyond, you will start to get into debates about what are mandated and non-mandated services, much like we did in 2007. We had for the 2007 budget in 2006, we had a significant debate about that. I've asked that we postpone that until we see what the state does. You may disagree with that and say, no, I want to take on X, Y, or Z service, and where are those cuts, and we have to look for more now. I believe that by postponing that until we see what happens in the state budget, that that builds a more cooperative relationship with our bargaining units. We do have challenges that we're working on, but again, you may disagree with that. We can continue to have a higher attention to increase fees or other revenue, but again, there aren't any easy things in there. We've always pushed and tried to maximize user fees as much as we can. You have debated that, but other revenue options aren't any easier as well. Remember when I've suggested that the vehicle tax is one option to deal with the costs. I haven't seen any board member jump up and down and say, let's quickly debate that. That is an option. You have that authority. You have other means of increasing fees on people, but we haven't tried to maximize that. You could decide that our budget is too tight and I've cut back on too many areas and you want to increase spending in some area that we haven't touched on. Or that the public says this is too tight, we want to increase spending in some area, and you either increase the operating levy, you cut some other service, or you use more fund balance or other reserves like excess sales tax. Finally, you may need to review and consider changes in your fund balance and reserve policies. I'd suggest that that's probably going to be a debate for 2012, because you will find that while we are within county policy on what our fund balances are, many counties don't have the kind of financial stability. I used Eau Claire as the example. They roll everything into the general fund. They don't have fund balances for various funds. I don't think that's the best long-term strategy, but you may disagree and raise that as a policy issue. We need to actually know where we have reserves and what for and those kinds of things.
Steve, how much are you taking from reserves this year, and how does that compare to prior years?
And I didn't ask him to lead into that question, but you have a blue sheet that we do every year for you that actually compares year by year what we use of fund balance. And let me walk through that since the chairman has brought that up. So each year we walk through this, and I'll walk through this again another time. It's organized by each one of the individual funds: general fund, land records assessment, special jail assessment. So, for example, exactly to the chairman's question, in the 2011 budget, we're budgeting for less use of general fund than we have in previous years, $295,000 versus $433,000. In this year, we're using a little bit more of the interest reserve fund, but not as much as we did in 2009. We're trying to get closer to budgeting what actual interest is. Remember, we got into a position where we were making so much interest on our reserves that it was helping out our budget so much, but then interest returns dropped off. Well, we'd already budgeted at that level, so we had to have some means, because we'd control property taxes with that. We had to have some means to do that, so we set aside a reserve. We're not using from the operating contingency to offset that, so we've gotten a little bit closer. We're using some of our salary contingency to help with the costs that are funding retiree health. Now, remember, retiree health is not like most counties or cities or school districts. Retiree health is only the people's sick leave that's unused that's going into the bank. It's not like some school districts will, if you retire, you get retiree health insurance at the school district's expense. This is just the portion that's funded by someone's sick leave. Next, excess sales tax. Again, that's the economic development that I talked about, and being such a great predictor of the future, the UW Stadium donation that Ray Ebert will raise a question about at some point. Design, you know that at Lake Neshonoc, we sold off a lot of property there to property owners there that took benefit of it. We'll talk about what that fund balance is, but we're suggesting, as always intended, that that money that was raised by that land sale should go to benefit the improvements around that around the lake and what are the services there. So the vault toilet and shelter at Lake Neshonoc, that'll be a capital expense that's included at the back of your budget book. Remember, capital is in the goldenrod pages at the end, but we would only use that money that was generated by the sales out there to benefit projects that are benefiting that area. Actually, that was the one suggestion that Dennis Manti asked me to look at was how is that money set aside. I think I gave you an email on it as well. I think it's a little bit over $200,000. I don't have the exact number memorized, but we're using part of that to actually, why not, rather than just leave it sit, let's get it invested back in services that will benefit that area. Land records assessment, we're always able to use that fund balance to benefit projects that are helping with land records. We're not using any special jail assessment, nothing from solid waste. We move over to the old landfill. Everybody will recall that strategy that once we reburied the garbage at the landfill into a new lined landfill, we didn't have to keep funding the old landfill environmental protection. We used a letter of credit to cover for that, but that meant that we had some cash left over, and we've used $1 million in 2009 for highways. We used $500,000 in 2010 and some short-term borrowing, and then in 2011, as we talked about last year, we'll use that $500,000 to help construct roads. And then in 2011, we won't be using that anymore. Aging fund, we've used a little bit. Supervisor Mettinger was asking about this at this morning's Aging and Long-Term Care. We're using some of the estate donation fund from the Darrell Larson estate to help deal with some of the levy costs in aging. Remember that we reduced levy in calendar year 2010 because of era stimulus funds that were directed to aging programs. This year, we're not going to get those anymore. So we've got some impact on our levy. So we're using aging unrestricted fund balance, the 8521, which is restricted to transportation, and a little bit of the Darrell Larson to help control that levy increase. And if you're really curious, you can go to the individual aging budget and see that. I'll walk that through with you when we do the individual governing committees. Health fund, again, we use a little bit of that to help moderate some of the costs in the health department. Human Services Fund, we've had a history of utilizing some of their fund balance, but again, not a drastic change from previous years. We've used it primarily for improvements in their case management software. We've used it to offset some of the justice sanctions chargebacks that happen, meaning that the services that are provided from Human Services fiscal staff to justice sanctions, we're using some of that rather than increasing the levy. Human Services W-2 Reserve, and finally our self-insurance health fund. So that was a rather long answer, but with details showing that, in essence, we're using slightly less fund balance from one year to the next for the purposes that are outlined. Any questions on that? I will touch on these again at future budget meetings. So if people say, well, gee, I didn't understand what you meant by that. Why were we doing that, and how do you justify that? So we'll come back through that. Again, I said this wasn't me a quiz tonight because this is the first time you've had the information, but I wanted to give you an overall viewpoint. Again, it would have been easy to use larger amounts of fund balance to help to control costs and spending. That's not what we did here. We've done pretty much a little bit less than we've done in previous years, and pretty similar. I just want to remind everybody that part of our discussion for the 2010 budget, and we'll come back as part of debt decisions this year, is that one of the changes you made from the administrator's recommended budget, what we called the budget alternative, was to use short-term debt for highway, and it's looking like this is going to work out as well or better than I had expected. We talked about, because the federal government had given us era stimulus borrowing authority of $1.6 million, we could borrow that at an estimated 2% interest rate for a five-year note. So you made the decision, along with our recommendation and help, that the highway fund balance is strong and could service that debt for the next several years, those payments, without increasing the debt levy. Because remember, we've got that same issue about making two debt payments, and I'll talk about that in a moment. So without raising property taxes, we budgeted this year, calendar year 2010, to borrow $1.6 million by the end of this year. That will end up accomplishing part of the road projects that we had this year, and then starting the first payment next year, and that'll ladder in over the 5 years. We'll do that for the next several years while we're making two LEC debt payments, and then when it drops off, we'll be able to make to be able to absorb that without necessarily having to do debt. And I'll walk through that again when we get back to that. But the last part is that by using the debt payment then spread over less than the life of the roads, obviously roads last longer than 5 years, and paid for using the highway fund balance, which continues to be strong, we end up getting ourselves through the period of time when the LEC is not going to have two payments due for the 1997 LEC and for the one we just are completing. Okay? And I've got to update this slide. Mary reminds me that this $4.2 million in 2011 is really $4.3. I've rounded that. But remember, the blue parts of the graph are the 1997 Law Enforcement Center. The burgundy, or the new levy, is for the new LEC. So if we can get through the next 4 years, 11, 12, 13, and 14, to when that that debt levy starts to drop off, then we can be in a better position to more easily evaluate the use of debt. Okay? So, the things that we're working with Springstead on to bring to you later on, and I'll show you a new revised calendar, that we want to evaluate all of our options on use of debt, obviously, is we want to look again at the 2010 highway debt that I just explained, the $1.6 million five-year debt paid for by the highway fund. We'll be making those payments. Now, we've since learned that the ERA borrowing authority needs to comply with federal prevailing wage law. So we're re-examining whether or not that that will impact our ability to use this for our work here. Short-term rates are already so low. In fact, short-term rates are well under 2% for this type of money. So we may or may not recommend to you using the ERA borrowing authority. We still have additional work to do on this, but we're evaluating. We still do need to borrow the money. That's still part of the 2010 budget, but the interest rates will probably be less than we were anticipating. So that's very positive news. We also, with the Hillview Assisted Living, we had looked at the idea of using potentially the ERA money for those, but that would also kick in a federal prevailing wage rate. And for those of you on the Aging Long-Term Care Committee, you knew this morning that we did not accept bids last week, as we had expected, because the architect had not included the state prevailing wage as a requirement in the bid documents. So we accepted the envelope, the sealed envelopes, from the four bidders that we received, and we returned them without opening them back to the bidders, and we are going to rebid this, and that's why you won't be voting on a bid recommendation this Thursday. I'll come back to the actual timeline on that, but we will evaluate all options in relation to doing that. It seems that ERA borrowing is not going to be useful. It will probably drive up the cost of the Hillview facility too much to honor prevailing wage for federal standards. So that's unlikely that we would make that recommendation. We are going to look at all options with Hillview Assisted Living. We'll look at what we've talked to you about with the borrowing from the general fund. We'll also look at outside borrowing. We'll look at borrowing from Carroll Heights. We'll make you a recommendation as part of that resolution once we receive the new bids. In addition to that, we're going to make a thorough reexamination of the state trust fund loans. As I mentioned earlier, the 2008 and 2010 state trust fund loans for the law enforcement center. Again, interest rates are very low right now, lower than the state trust fund interest rates that were charged to us, so we're going to examine whether or not it's beneficial to refinance those. Again, there was no issuance cost by funding through the state trust fund, so we're not wasting issuance costs by refinancing. You've got to be careful with that when you refinance. You don't want to do it too frequently because you'll end up, you know, double paying on your issuance costs. And finally, it was back to Supervisor Bina's question. In 2004, we refinanced, it was closer to $4 million, Gary? Thank you, $4,754,000. We refinanced of prior year service that the actuaries at WRS came back and charged every county for. We made a decision in 2004 with this board that rather that was best to finance through a debt issuance, and so that rate is, I think, 5.25% right now. And we think we may be able to get a better interest rate and save property tax levy, because that's actually not serviced by your debt levy. It's serviced by your operating levy, and it's actually a line item in every single budget that has staff. So there may be a way of dropping levy additionally with some of these ideas. Okay. The last item then that I'll touch on is the actual calendar. Mary, if you could go that, the clicker's not working. So the updated schedule related to all forms of debt issuance, including the assisted living facility, is that the new bid opening for the Hillview Assisted Living Facility will be October 7th. That recommendation, once staff has analyzed it and confirmed who the low compliant bidder is, will go to the October 11th Aging and Long-Term Care Committee at their regular meeting. There will be a resolution that I will propose that will include both the method of borrowing or debt funding as well as the decision to award a bid, so that we will not have two separate decisions. Eventually you'll have to make a decision actually doing debt if we sell outside debt, but I want to make sure that's all tied in together. You don't want to award a bid and then refuse to fund it. You want to have that debate right here and make that decision at the same time, at least in my estimation. October 26th will be the executive committee. We'll bring the initial resolution on any borrowing that you will do that will require a bond sale, so that will allow us to create the official statement and be able to move ahead with that. On November 1st at your county board policy planning meeting would be calling for the sale. That's called the initial resolution, and then the sale of bonds would be awarded December 6th. For executive committee members, this means we will not need to move your regular executive meeting in October. Remember, we are going to move from, and we'll send out a notice on this, from October 13th to October 6th to be able to accomplish the bond resolution. We won't be doing it this way because of the change in the Hillview borrowing. Again, I'm not positive that we would use outside borrowing for Hillview's assisted living if you approve that, but we still want to be in a position we can consider all debt at the same time. So that's my entire presentation, other than to highlight some of the handouts that were included. Any questions about what I just presented?
Questions.
All good questions, by the way.
Any other questions?
Okay, included in your budget as separate sheets, because I didn't want to bury them on some particular page, is a list of the outside agencies that are included in the budget as recommended. So if you want to debate those, but these are very easily at your fingertips rather than trying to find them in any individual budget. In addition to that is the detailed listing of the recommendation in the administrator's budget of how to handle indirect costs. You'll notice that some are actually increased, but not drastically. Some are changed from the 2010 budget, so we are up slightly in recovering additional revenues, but we have not changed several of them. So, for example, library, we could charge more under full recovery, but we made the judgment call to leave that at the same from 2010 to 2011. Hillview Healthcare Center, we generally have not gone to full cost, but I've increased them by twice as much as what we charged in 2010 from 2010 to 2011. There are some other minor changes there that you can follow along, but we wanted to give you that exact detail, so if you want to redebate any of those items, and again, I'm making a prediction that Ray Ebert will ask us to redebate a couple of those. So, again, I'm Kreskin. I can predict things. That's Karnak, yeah, I'm Karnak, yeah, exactly. Karnak, Kresk, and whatever. It's been a while since Johnny was around, so. Okay.
Any other questions for Steve?
You also have two additional items, which are a summary of the 2009 fund balances for your entire comprehensive annual financial report, and then a detail, as we do every year, of the excess sales tax. So that is my entire presentation, and I'm out of breath. So.
I asked Steve this morning how long this presentation would take, and he said half an hour, so I think his half hour is almost up.
But you didn't tell the rest. I said, or an hour and a half, because people will laugh at my jokes and applaud when I'm done. So.
Any other questions anybody has? Jim Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Steve. With the first sheet in our budget books, the yellow sheet, that identifies, like last year, the top departments that has seen an increase, where all the departments that have, that shows the changes from last 2010, but levy increase, correct?
And it's always organized in the order of the largest change in levy.
To the least, yeah. So I guess non-departmental sticks out, because I don't think that was a top 10 or maybe a top 5 last year. And right. Is that because of the loss in interest income? Or
it's interest income. It's what's that?
Sales tax.
Sales tax reduction. Is that 1096 is the org?
1064.
Sorry, I thought I'd impress somebody by memorizing that. Let's see. The biggest changes, if you go to page 38, so everybody can follow along. Let's see. Interest revenue was a big, has been a big decrease from 2010. Board approved was $1.4 million to $1.1 million, so that was a significant decrease in revenue. Let's see, what were the other increases? Sales tax was a drop by $175,000.
Okay, half came from the interest. Okay.
Yeah, we're not applying operating contingency to reduce levy in this area. We spent all of the operating contingency against this, so that's probably the largest change was $350,000. Anyway, so that's there.
Anybody else, Ralph?
No, I was going to move to exhaust the speaker list. I mean, or whatever you got to do. I'm saying the closed session could be lengthy. I'm looking at this.
No, it won't be.
It won't be. The last one wasn't going to be either, but.
I just asked Bill a moment ago if he's going to take as long as Steve, and he said no. Not that Steve's wasn't informative and helpful and well planned out.
You won't hurt my feelings, and I know you're not worried. So.
All right. So anybody else have any questions for Steve? All right. Cars and correspondence over there. No meetings during recess. That gets us to closed session. Let me note for Samantha and the Tribune that our closed session is expected to be relatively short. We will not be taking any votes, so there will be nothing really to report out from closed session. So you're welcome to hang out, but it won't be real exciting when you come back. All right. I think I see Jerry Sobranik moving to go into closed session pursuant to Wisconsin State Statute Section 19.85, Parent 1G, conferring with legal counsel for the governmental body who is rendering oral or written advice concerning strategy to be adopted by the body with respect to litigation, which it is or likely to be involved, to wit, claims of the state of J. King, T. Lynch, S. Sage, the state of R. Hawkins, the state of W. Harder, P. Paff Olson, and K. Dreesen. Moved by Jerry Sobranik to go into closed session, as I just read, seconded by John Menninger. All in favor going to closed session, as I noted, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried unanimously. We are in closed session.
Those are going to the WCA convention conference. I would highly suggest that you consider taking the Amtrak at least through La Crosse, and gets down there around noon or so. But it's extremely reasonable. You can never drive your car, rent a car, and receive a ton of money for the county of La Crosse. I believe Jill told me tonight that she just recently purchased a ticket, and for about $60 round trip. I purchased mine about 3 months ago and got the senior citizens rate for just a little bit less of about $54. So it hasn't changed much. It's kind of like supply and demand. The more people that get on the train, the higher the prices are going to be as they run out of seats. And getting there a weekend, you could probably get a load of college students traveling back and forth, which could fill it up. So I'd recommend, I think the depot's open from 8:30 to 11:30 and until about, I think, 5 or 6, about 7:30 at night. So I would call and go down and get a ticket if you're going to go to the conference.
Charge you more for online? Okay. Well, anyway, I think Jerry makes a good point. If you're going to WCA, I would encourage you to look into taking the train. My understanding is that those trips have been fairly enjoyable in the past, thanks to Arlene and her skills with bartending, which almost got them kicked off of the train at one point, I understand, in which case traveling with those college students might be a good idea, actually. All right, any other items for future agendas? Maureen Friedland.
Could you just keep us apprised as to what the committee that's looking at county board size is doing, or who the committee is?
We have our first meeting coming up 21st. So we're doing nothing yet.
Okay.
At that meeting, what we'll be talking about is kind of laying out the roadmap for where we're going. The first issues that would need to be decided are a range for board size and this idea of whether we would want staggered terms or not. We don't get the numbers from the Census Bureau until after the first of the year, so the real activity of that committee will be next spring, mid to late spring. But no reason why we can't at least talk a range at this point of what board size should be.
Okay, and what time is that meeting at?
On the
20th? Okay, 20th at what time? 2 o'clock. And, of course, everybody's welcome to attend if you're interested. Where? 3220, the normal room for meetings.
September 20th.
September 20th, so coming up in about a week or so. So. Any other items people have, items for future agenda? If not, I think that Bob Kyle has his hand up. Move to adjourn, seconded by Dennis Montai. All in favor of adjourning, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried unanimously. Thank you all.